You're listening to the Headless WP Podcast, where we discuss all things headless WordPress. The Headless WP Podcast is a production of the WP Engine Developer Relations Team. If you're interested in more content on headless WordPress, check out developers.wpengine.com for blog posts, tutorials, videos, and more. All right, welcome to the Headless WP Podcast. This is our first episode being recorded in 2023. I got that year right. I am Jeff Everhart, your host, and I am joined today, as always, by my stoked co-host, Fran Agalto, and our guest with us is Johnny Harris. Johnny is a London-based WordPress developer specializing in large-scale WordPress projects, and he runs the Spaced Monkey Consultancy. Johnny's been developing websites for over 10 years and is most known for his open source work in WordPress Core, where he's worked on things like Gutenberg, multi-site, and the REST API. His list of former clients and employers includes names like the Time Inc. UK, Google, Unsplash, and Skyscanner, some really big names. And over the last year or so, Johnny has worked with the performance team in WordPress Core to make WordPress faster and more performant. So we're here to pick his brain around all things WordPress backend. So Johnny, Fran, how's it going?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Jeff, pleasure.
Jeff, stoked as always. And I think for this first year episode, you know me, man, I'm always stoked to learn new things. All our listeners who've been following us this past year know that, man, I'm a dummy when it comes to the REST API, so I cannot wait to get educated on this because I've been swimming in GraphQL. So welcome, Johnny. I appreciate your presence on our podcast today.
For sure. We're trying to make sure everybody is well represented. All the API options are well represented. But cool. Yeah. So like this is just always our kickoff question, Johnny. So if you could just kind of give us a little bit of background on you, like what was your journey into web development? How did you get into WordPress? And what did that look like for you?
Yeah, so I started using WordPress when I was 15. I wanted a blog, and 2005, blogs were cool. And I looked at the various
blogs are still. I think blogs are still cool.
Blogs are coming back. I'm, with the slow heat death of Twitter, I'm seeing blogs come back up again. I looked at the various different options, and I installed WordPress. So 2005, we're talking. WordPress 1.5, 1.2, something like that. I remember when plugins were added. Like that's how long I've been on working with WordPress. Anyway, so I had a blog when I was at high school, and then went off to university, did a degree in computer network management and design. But then had various WordPress clients on the side. I then joined an decided I didn't want to be a network engineer. I just loved doing this WordPress stuff.
Wow.
So joined a very small agency as the third employee, and managed to convince them from using bespoke Java systems to using this open source thing called WordPress. And their year backlog of work that they had, I completed that in 6 weeks because I could spin up sites for super quick.
Oh.
And they were like, oh yeah, that's why Johnny has been talking about this for the last year. Like this is really cool tech. And then by the time I left there was 12 developers working for me. I was very young. I was like 24. And I was like, I had ridiculous amounts of responsibility for that age. I decided I want a new challenge. So I joined Time Inc., which at the time was the UK's largest magazine publisher. And what I thought I knew about WordPress in my like 6 years experience, like doing all this theme work, and thought I was so like, so cool and knew so much. I realized I knew absolutely nothing, and had a massive imposter syndrome, and spent months, literally months of my life going home every day and researching as much as I could about object caching and database sharding and all these cool things, and started to soon realize that I'd become an expert in it. This inferiority complex was actually a good thing, and that I'd learned a lot. And we were self-hosting in AWS at the time, very early doors on AWS. And we had new Reddit graphs, and we'd see random spikes in our performance and stuff like that. So I started creating issues on Track, realized they weren't getting enough attention, so I started writing my own patches and started attending the multi-site meetings. And over the course of a couple of years, Loki rewrote a lot of how multi-site works. So instead of it being lots of raw database queries, it now uses like a WP site query, which is my biggest contribution into core. And I got absolutely hooked. So that was 2013 that I was doing that work, and I'm still 9 years later contributing to core.
So there's two things I got to unpack.
The performance work that I'm doing at the moment is actually tickets I created in 2013 that I didn't have time to work on. I'm still working through a backlog of tickets that I created years ago.
That takes a lot of patience to try
and get your head back into a mindset of 9 years ago when you wrote the ticket.
There was an object caching thing. I don't want to skip ahead, but there was an object caching ticket that was just recently merged that was like 6 years old, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've got a ticket that was 14 years old, merged not too long ago.
14 years?
Yeah, the stuff that I fixed that was that's not even WordPress, like before it was WordPress, I fixed some of that stuff. Because WordPress is a fork. I don't know if you realize this, but I've like fixed a bunch of that stuff as well. Crazy old tickets. I'm very stubborn about getting that stuff done. But anyway, to finish my story, I was at Time for a couple of years, and that was an amazing experience. What ran this massive multi-site that was like one of the biggest traffic sites in the UK and around the world. Then I went traveling for a bit, and then I decided to start my own consultancy. So 6 years ago, I made Space Monkey Limited Consultancy, and I've been working with various enterprise clients to make sure WordPress scales.
Awesome. So there's two things I want to hop back and unpack from your background story. So you said this agency that you first worked at was using some sort of bespoke Java system to create websites for people?
Yeah. It was their university project. It had like comments in the code that were like the module that it was for their university project.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That's insane to me. And I've always kind of wondered that, like how did people manage this stuff? Because I would say I started using WordPress like 2007, 2008. So just a couple of years after you, it was obviously a little bit more mature at that point. And I didn't know anything at that point. Like I just picked it up, use it as a content author, publish stuff. But I always kind of wonder that, like, how were these people approaching some of these large website projects before they had the tooling that they have now? And I can only imagine that it was
the
miserable.
The bootstrapping process was an absolute nightmare because you had to build the tables yourself. Manually build all the tables yourself, build all the database connections yourself, create abstraction layers. I mean, Java is incredibly verbose about, like, you have to print line is five lines of code. Like, it's just, it's insane.
Wow.
And, like, the biggest problem they had was just, like, the very basic stuff you just expect from WordPress of just setting it up. That took 2 weeks to set up.
Two weeks?
Imagine a bootstrap process that doesn't take a day, it takes 2 weeks to bootstrap.
Yeah. And I've written some C# before. That's as close as I've gotten to Java. Yeah. Oh, cool. I mean, I worked at a .NET shop one time. Exactly that. Like everything you wanted took you twice as long because everything was strongly typed and, you know, very verbose.
So was C# dev experience as awful, you're saying?
I don't know. I've never worked. Okay. It was all right. I came to like it at the end, but I'd much rather be writing JavaScript. PHP, if I'm being honest.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And so the second thing is like, can you talk with me a little bit about the Times multi-site setup? Because that's always interesting. And we're getting a lot more questions from people who are interested in doing things with multi-site.
Yes, we are.
And the last podcast episode we published was with Rob Humar from Desertos, where they have a multi-site, you know, set up and they're doing headless work with it. So there's like, and I think a lot of this through line runs through the publishing, right? Like these big magazines or newspapers and stuff like that. So could you talk to me a little bit about what that looked like?
Oh man, I could do a 3-hour presentation about that. that multi-site is incredibly sophisticated. So like so there was I think 80 sites on there, but they're incredibly high traffic sites. And the way that the business was broken up is the various different brands were broken into like categories. I can't remember the name of them. They're all called some buzzwordy thing like Inspire and innovate and all this sort of stuff that's not really important to this conversation. But there were like basically it's like the low end male brands are like the sports brands were one. There was low end female brands that were like chat and soap opera magazines, and then there was high end like Marie Claire and InStyle and all that sort of stuff. Those are how I mentally broke up in my head. And we use a multi site. We use something called a multi network. So what people don't realize about multi site is you can also have this idea of multiple networks of sites. So if you've ever looked at the WordPress database, you have the naming of this is incredibly confusing, but you have sites and blogs. A site is a network and a blog is a site, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. It's very, very old naming that we can't change because of backwards compatibility, but you have this idea. So default multi-site is just one network of sites, but you can have this idea of multiple networks. So we had one installation of WordPress, but we had multiple networks within that installation. And what that meant is you could have on one network, some people were super admins, but they weren't super admin in a different network. So if we had publishers that were going across all of the magazines on a particular network of sites, they could go in and edit wherever they wanted, but they couldn't go in and edit the male brands or the different kinds of brands. And that was really important for the business because it meant that you wouldn't have someone from Marie Claire editing Soccer World because they had no right to start editing that stuff.
Yeah, and they have no knowledge about it. Soccer. Yeah.
And from a business standpoint, you have integrity of data as well. So some random person that's in this site. And multi-site was incredibly useful for them because they had like freelancers that were working on projects, so they could assign them to multiple brands, so they could do articles. And it being one installation of WordPress meant that if we rolled out changes, they would roll out across all of them when we pushed changes out. But it also came with other problems as well because we were self-hosting in AWS. We had database issues. So just putting everything on one massive database didn't work. So we then started using a plugin called HyperDB, which is a plugin that allows you to shard database connections. So you can have this idea in database things of read replicas, sometimes called master and slave, but they're trying to move away from that name closure for very obvious reasons because it's kind of problematic naming. So if I do use that, I'm just remembering the old way of saying it. But you can have read replicas. So basically you have a database and then it whenever you write to the master database, it will write to the other databases as well. So you have one master database that you write to, and then you have faster read replicas, what they're called. So front end traffic, when it comes in, you can say if it's coming in on the front end, just hit the read replicas because those are bigger, faster database instances. And then the main database, the master, doesn't get taken down. So, and you have this thing what's called a round robin. So you have three read replicas, and it just on a loop goes. First connection goes to one, second connection goes to three, and you just loop through. So if anything goes wrong, you can actually spin up more instances. So you can have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and it would just round robin if you're hitting major data.
It's like a failover. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's system. It's wild. And HyperDB was an automatic. Was that that's what WordPress.com uses.
So it's what WordPress.com was written on.
Okay.
Just to continue the thing, we had read replicas, and each network had its own database instances.
Okay,
so we had four networks and four pools of database servers. So we said for site ID 123, go to this database instance.
Yeah.
For the difference, and we had to have like a manual map because there was no easy way to map it. We had like a YAML file that we parsed through, and it would go through the different connections. But and then we had a global database that stored some global data that was going across all the networks. So like users were stored in there, network information, network options were all stored in a global database. It was a massive instance, and so it wouldn't go down. But that was a single point of failure that I was trying to get to work. But yeah, incredibly sophisticated system. But it also meant that like we could do separate billing as well. So we had this one instance, but then we could say all the traffic goes to this database instance, we can charge us to this part of the business and that sort of stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Well, cool. Yeah, and, I mean, we'll dig into Ludacris and stuff. Yeah,
So HyperDB was a plugin written for WordPress.com, but it was not well maintained. I bugged a bunch of people at Automattic to try and get it updated. We were obviously using it and finding bugs and stuff with it. And when we tried to upgrade to PHP 7, it failed because there was some weird and wonderful PHP feature or function that they were using and it didn't work. So getting really frustrated, we forked it internally. And I was like, oh, I don't like this because I'm all about open source and I want to make sure this is available in the world. So I was about to publish my own version of it. And then a friend of mine, JJJ, who's awesome. If you don't follow him, do look him up. Mm-hmm. He's the maintainer of Buddy Press and a million other things and has been around the project forever. He had a fork that had called LudacrisDB that had a few little tweaks in it. And I messaged him privately. I was like, I've low-key rewritten this. It's awesome. There's unit tests. There's all this stuff. Do you want me to push this to your repo? So, and instead of another fork or another fork, we can just work on this together. And over the years, we've pushed lots of changes to it. We've made sure it keeps up to track with the changes to the database classes and core and maintain it. Because, if anyone's out there using HyperDB, please, please use LudacrisDB. It's the maintained version. HyperDB is 7-8 years old at this point and has not received any love from Automattic.
Yeah, and there was a third one too, maybe MultiDB.
Yeah, I mean this is part of the reason that I was saying I didn't want to be another fork of it. Doesn't really help the problem if everyone just forking it. And I was like, no, I trust JJJ, he's a good guy. I want let's do this together. And obviously it would have been way easier for me to just literally create my own repo and just push the code up and forget about it. I have to cooperate with JJJ and we have to talk about stuff. It adds some overhead to me, but I think consolidating this all together is worthwhile. And in times where I've not had time to focus on it, JJJ does it. So you get that massive benefit. And a lot of big companies have used it. I know HumanMade is a big WordPress agency and they've contributed back as well. Trying to get wrangling community to focus on one thing instead of everyone just forking it is the goal. Because especially with a lot of performance tools, everyone wants their own thing and they want the control of it. But we all get benefits if we all contribute together. And if it means having a filter or a hook or giving users options, configuration options, so that it can be malleable for 10 different use cases instead of just one, that adds overhead to me of the maintainer of it. But the value it adds of getting people from HumanMade to contribute to it is well worth the pain in the neck that it is to maintain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And so I had a whole separate question about LudacrisDB. And so I think we might as well just skip ahead to that. Cause we could talk about this forever. Cause I actually used not Ludacris. I think we used MultiDB, but so my previous job, I worked at a university where we had a large multi-site thing and, lots of departments had their sites on there, but students and teachers could also go and create their own sites. Right when I left, I think we had something 36,000 sites on this multi-site. Not a ton of traffic, at this point it's student coursework and stuff like that. But it was a very weird load pattern because it wasn't so much read heavy as it was write heavy. So imagine you've got thousands of students who are all have a course assignment due in that same week. And they're all just writing to this one database. So that's what we ended up doing was sharding this database out using, I think, MultiDB. And then I had looked at one point before I left it, switching to Ludacris, and also looked at, cause a lot of that sounds super complicated. But I did some exploratory work. And so you said you were using AWS for this. Were you all using RDS for the database piece?
I think we started off at RDS, then we used Aurora, which is so that has the read replication built in. So it does some clever thing under the hood around when things are written to the database, it creates a bin file and it somehow syncs the bin file between multiple database servers. It doesn't trigger an actual write. It just copies the underlying thing to write to the file system. I'm probably explaining that completely awfully. It's been 7 years since I thought about any of this stuff, if I'm completely honest. It does a bunch of that read replica stuff magic under the hood.
And basically, and that's what I was going to say. It's like a lot of this sounds super complex, but when I went and explored this with AWS, like it was kind of pricey to use the RDS service. But I think I was able to do it with maybe just vanilla MySQL, like MySQL, like that click one button, specify, you know, your secondary read replica, and it would handle all of that stuff for you. And that's how we ended up sharding ours. I forget how we did it, but it was like, yeah, we basically looked at the blog ID and then, you know, that mapped to a particular database. But that's really neat. So like,
Multi-site like that, I would strongly recommend not running more than about 1,000 tables for a single database.
Okay.
Because then backups and stuff and restores become an absolute nightmare. Because if you've got, because consider an average WordPress site has what, 11 to 13 tables, times that by 40,000, you're talking hundreds of thousands of tables at that point. Sure. And if somebody 30 gigs. Yeah, someone completely balks their site and they say, oh, can you restore it? And you've got to restore 30 gigabytes, and then it might take multiple hours, and then a ton of people might lose their data. Whereas you can do, like, because all WordPress multi-site tables are prefixed with a number, so you can do like, it's like WP_2 on that site ID. You can just do a very simple bit of regex to get that ID, and then just do path switching depending on the ID. So if the number is above the number 1,000, then go off to database instance 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then you can even do another level of automation on top of that, of saying, if database 5 has reached its limit of 1,000 tables, spin up a new database instance using Terraform or some other automation.
Oh, wow.
Automatically add it to the pool, and then it automatically will scale forever at that point, as long as you don't have a bunch of people
spamming.
I've heard of that happening as well. And then you're spreading concerns at that point, because as I say, you know, if you're going to get attacked, that you get DDoS and someone, you know, the database is a massive point of failure for WordPress, right? Unless you're using, you have to have multiple levels of mitigation around like object caching, CDNs, all this sort of stuff. But if someone's hitting your origin and continually spamming your database, it's going to take your site down, because at some point the number of connections or long, especially because WordPress search is totally unoptimized. All you need to do to take a site down is just write a script to do every dictionary word against WordPress search. Almost impossible to cache. And it's gonna hit the server really hard. It's doing a like search.
So
again, I'm not telling secrets here that WordPress, like, you know, anyone with a brain could probably work this out pretty simply. But unfortunately, search becomes a massive vector for being attacked, unfortunately.
Man. Yeah, that's wild.
And I think did you have, I don't know if you followed Pressbooks at all. Did you read about their? No.
What's Pressbooks?
So they're Pressbooks. They've kind of forked WordPress into like a more book publishing format. And so it's for making like open educational resources, right? Like books. Yeah, mainly books. Pressbooks, right? But they have a giant multi-site setup, and like they did, you know, some migration, exactly what you said. Like they just couldn't handle it on one database server, and ended up, you know, doing, I think, actually using LudicrousDB, and they maybe millions of tables or something they ended up migrating, or maybe a million sites even. It was really, really impressive.
That's
to see.
Gnarly.
Have you ever seen anybody do this with just one WordPress instance, or is it mainly multi-site that kind of falls prey to this?
I've seen people use LudicrousDB for single site instances for the read replica.
Okay.
Aspect of it. But if you're doing
so
it for
sharding,
if you're doing it for a single, at that point you're having multiple database instances for like single tables, and then that like adds overhead. That's a pain in the neck at that point. But you can do read replicas by just using DNS. So you can say, you know, you have one DNS endpoint that's like mysql.spacemonkey.com, and then you can have something that's sitting there in between you that's doing the round robin.
Oh, okay. Like Nginx or something.
some again, yeah, an ops person's aren't, I don't know, some witchcraft okay. happening there that's doing the round robin aspect of it. So you don't need
you could use Nginx, Jeff. Yeah, you could.
some magic, I don't know. Yeah. And you can do that without needing Ludicrous DB or Hyper DB.
Oh, that's that's nuts.
If you really want to nerd out about database stuff, have you heard the performance projects working on a SQLite implementation for WordPress?
I did see that.
Wait, what?
Yeah, that was really cool. So yeah, go for it. I mean,
For those that don't know, obviously standard WordPress uses MySQL or MariaDB for its database infrastructure.
Yeah.
But because the database layer is kind of abstracted a little bit, you can, with a little bit of effort, use a different database type. So SQLite is a very not very resource intensive SQL like database that actually ships with PHP. So it's under the hood, PHP uses it for some stuff. It's actually if you're running Mac, the database layer in many apps is using SQLite because it's like super, super low, lightweight database, right? And what this means is if you can use WordPress with SQLite, you don't need a different database server. You can literally run WordPress just with vanilla PHP on your site. And what that means as well is, I think Matt Mullenweg demoed it in his presentation. There's this new thing called WordPress Playground, which is a JavaScript instance of WordPress. So you don't need any database or anything at all. You can literally run it on your local machine using Node. What that's doing is it's using I'm going to horribly misexplain this, but let me stick with it. There's like a web assembler allows you to transpile PHP into JavaScript on the fly. Because you're transpiling PHP, and because you don't need a database because you're using SQLite, you can literally run an instance of WordPress in your browser. That technology is so freaking cool and opens up so many different options for people. I mean, you know, WP Engine has amazing options around like having staging environments, but imagine having an environment. Imagine you're testing a PR or a patch or something, and you can click a button and it automatically spins up your instance, applies the patch to it, and you can be playing around with this instance, screw around it as much as you want, break it, close the browser window, and it's gone. Like making WordPress that level of portable, the sky's the limit when it comes
to WordPress. That's wild.
It's really awesome. I do think that's something that's missing. Like I have one headless starter that I had, and it was like somebody was like, this is great, but I'd really like, I don't know anything about WordPress. I'm into Astro, but I don't know anything about WordPress. Like, is there like a playground, like how do I get started? And it was like, well, you got to download this, and like maybe I can give you an export, but then you've got to import it somewhere. And like I can't really just have
sandbox before WordPress.
This. Yeah, I mean, I can't really just add you as an editor to my thing without you also being able to break it. And so like this I think will solve a lot of problems and lower the barrier for people who just want to explore and learn and stuff. And I think that's amazing.
Man, that's
the SQLite thing is neat too, just because like, I mean, that imagine the resource imprint of WordPress. And like, I don't know if you want to think about the carbon to run all those database servers that could now be go away. And like some people I'm sure will still want or need a full, you know, MySQL implementation, but I can imagine
sites are just static little sites that are brochure sites.
Five pages.
Shop on your high street you know, like the number, or even, and so what like WordPress.com does, I don't know if they're still doing this, is if you don't access a site in a certain amount of time, they actually they turn your site into a static site, and then you log in again, it will take a zip file out of an archive, re-instantiate your site. So it has like this, like WordPress.com has this automatic idea of like archiving your site. But even if you could do that with converting it to a database, your database to SQLite, and it has a much lower overhead. And the thing with SQLite is it's not great for super high traffic sites. It's not great for searching as well, as a bit of a weak spot, as I understand.
Well, but multiple authoring, I saw at least one comment on that thread about like maybe it was more prone to being overwritten in the wrong way or something.
So because you're writing, the database is basically a file on the file system, mm-hmm. right? And if you have like 20 people editing it at once, then you have possibility of concurrency issues around files being overwritten and all that sort of stuff, long-running PHP sessions. I'm not saying it's a perfect solution. It's just still really cool for local mm-hmm. development, for very small sites, maybe little side hustles that you've got that you just want to throw up something really quickly, and it's not, you don't worry about it scaling. Like, it's opened so many doors for developers to do cool stuff.
And it's just really neat to see innovation happening outside of the block editor, in my opinion. I'm happy anytime that happens.
It's so at the moment I'm working on the WordPress core performance project, and it's really exciting to work on the core performance project, because as you say, like, Gutenberg has got so much attention over the last couple of years, and you know, as also a maintainer of the Gutenberg project, I'm really excited for everything that's happened there. But we're a big community, and there's space to innovate in multiple vectors in mm-hmm. WordPress. And
exactly. I think
we have an opportunity to do some really cool stuff with the performance project.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let me take a step back, because we jumped ahead in our questions a little bit, because that Ludicrous DB conversation was so awesome. Mm-hmm. So you also done some really impressive client work mm-hmm. for some big names like Google, Unsplash. Could you talk a little bit about some of those projects?
Yeah, so the last 3 years I've been working on the Google Web Stories project. So that, if you don't know, Web Stories are like an open version of, you know, like Instagram Stories and all those sort of things, but uses AMP technology to be super, super performant. So we've been building a custom React editor, not using Gutenberg at all, completely custom React and custom REST APIs to build an editor so you can create stories. So you can do multiple page stories. There's so many cool things around that project. The coolest thing I think we did was around video transcoding. So WordPress, unfortunately, out of the box doesn't have any video transcoding. So we actually implemented a library that will transcode videos in the browser. So it uses WebAssembly, I was mentioning earlier. If you drag in a massive MP4, 4 gigabyte MP4, it will take that file. It will use in your browser session, will transcode it to... so you can take a 4 gigabyte file and it will turn it into like kilobyte size file.
Oh, what?
In the browser, and then upload the file.
Wow, that's cool. That's pretty cool.
I feel like we need to unpack WebAssembly real quick, just in case. Like nobody's used it before. Like how would you describe that, Johnny?
Yeah.
Like
so WebAssembly allows you to run like, I would say, like proper code and proper things in your browser. So it's not just like little JavaScript things where you can manipulate DOM. You can actually, with relative ease, port very big libraries to run in the browser. So you can run
this could be anything, right? Rust. Java.
You can do like really big things. So I'm forgetting the library, but it's a really popular library for transcoding video. There's a WebAssembly version of it. There's some caveats around it. You have to send some headers and stuff to isolate it, because it creates like sub processes in your browser, mm-hmm. so it runs it in isolation. You have to send proper headers, security headers and stuff, to make sure it works. The reason for this was it was open, and then people were using it to mine Bitcoin on people's machines. So people were going,
of course, they
going to a website.
Of course, they were, Johnny. Yeah,
like I'm this meme website is really cool. What my CPU uses is 100%. What's happening here?
Wow, man.
So you know, just because the internet is the way it is, that's why we can't have nice things.
Power in the search for extraterrestrial life or something without that extra power, but we're mining Bitcoin.
So you have to jump through some hoops to get it to work, but once you've got it working, you can really do some very, very sophisticated stuff. Unsplash, another really interesting project. So Unsplash is one of the world's largest open image repository. So you can integrate that into your site. So we built a plugin that builds on top of WordPress's media library, adds an extra tab, which is incredibly difficult because WordPress's media library is written in this ancient technology called Backbone. Mm-hmm. And I'm now a low-key expert in this very ancient technology that's zero use to the world. And with the news that they're killing that,
like, I've never heard it back, but
yeah, but you've used it every day for years because you've used WordPress. It's nuts. It's just really like before React and all these other frameworks, Backbone was the hotness. WordPress was right to use it 11 years ago. It's not right to be using it today. We should have rewritten the media library many, many years ago, but no one wants to touch it because it's an incredibly difficult problem to solve with accessibility and infinite scrolling and all these other problems. With the latest version, they are planning to rewrite it. And when Matt Mullenweg announced that, I was popping champagne. I was so excited. It's the media library is such a key user interface that needs so much love and needs to be so optimized. Anyway, so we added Unsplash into that. So it allowed you to click on a new tab called Unsplash. You could search within it. It would insert it as image blocks. You could use cover images. It even works with force editing. So you can have your big banner images and it hot links it from Unsplash. So you save bandwidth. It does a bunch of really cool stuff,
that's awesome.
The best part about it was we made sure that when it wasn't just hot linking the images, it also downloaded a copy locally and that kept a reference. So if you did deactivate the plugin, it would keep the local instance. It would revert back to the old instance. And that's one of my problems I have with, and I'll throw some shade at the WordPress industry, is a lot of times you install the plugin and then you're then beholden to the plugin forevermore. Mm-hmm. Like there's no real path other than like writing your own custom migration scripts. You know, like if you added like a shortcode or a custom block, what happens when you deactivate the plugin? A bunch of broken blocks or a bunch of broken shortcodes, right? We really spent months of work to make sure that it wouldn't do that. If you wanted to extract yourself from using the plugin, you could deactivate the plugin. And adding that mapping and stuff was incredibly sophisticated and difficult. And then Skyscanner, I did some really interesting work around. They had a multi-site and they had a bunch of legal documents, legal pages they needed to update. So I helped them write a Python script that would connect to the REST API and automatically push changes to their legal pages. Inspired my talk in 2009 around REST API authentication. So I had to do discovery around that to do that. And I was like, well, I've learned all this stuff for client work. I might as well write a presentation about it.
Yeah, for sure. You got to double dip. Got to double dip where you can. And that's a good segue, too, into some of the stuff that you've done on the REST API. And like, I've got a bunch of questions, too. And I know we're getting up there in the time. So we can feel free to condense some of this stuff. Like, there's so much stuff that you've worked on. Like, I don't know you want to talk about some of the performance features and work on the performance team. Like, I also know for our headless listeners, you also wrote a plugin to add structured block data to the REST API, which I think is really cool. Working on ways to do that right now with WP GraphQL. And obviously you have this deep expertise in the API and authentication. So like anything you want to talk about and any of that stuff. Yeah, go for it.
My experience with headless is in 2017, I wrote a project for a large social network. That you're probably on that I can't talk about, but
that cannot be named.
It's blue. I'll give you that's a clue. And it's not Twitter, so that's another clue.
That was my first thing. Twitter or Meta?
So at the time, I wrote some custom API. So we were building a site for them. It was a headless site. It was React. It was very, very early days of React as well. Again, we had to write a custom. I wrote for the first headless site I did. We had to write a very custom login process for that blue social network. You might imagine that use like JWT tokens and that provider's login and stuff like that. So I learned incredible amounts of stuff from that. And typically when I contribute to something, it's like I learn it very deeply and then I turn around and go, oh crap, I'm now the guy that knows the most in the world about this. So I probably should start pushing this information back in the world. I feel like it's a responsibility at that point.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. The REST API team did an amazing job. And the REST API is just freaking awesome. Like the code is so solidly written. Like it's obviously written with such architecture in mind, but a lot of that team was really burnt out at the time, rightly so. They spent literally years pushing this stone up a hill and a lot of them left, and left it with basically two maintainers, and I was like, I can help here. Even if it's just, you know, answering tickets and helping groom stuff, I will help wherever I can. So yeah, I've been maintaining the REST API for a number of years. With Gutenberg being so restful in its React, REST APIs have been so important to do. One of the things that I've been a really real advocate for is making the REST API useful for everything. So it's all very good, well and good that the REST APIs work for Gutenberg, but I'm thinking about your listeners, like people that want to use the REST API for Headless, for their own plugins and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And just building it for one use case is not really, it's not really friendly to the community, and it's kind of short-sighted, because if you just build your REST API for one client, what happens when there's another client, you know, when Gutenberg's not a thing anymore in 10 years' time, we're using Gutenberg 30 or whatever it is, and it's using a completely different technology, writing ourselves into a corner of just assuming it's going to be this one client that's going to be in JavaScript is foolhardy. And we need to remember this is a multi-generational project. We're 20 years into WordPress's story at this point.
That's wild.
And it's not stopping anytime soon, right? In 10 years' time, whenever I think about anything I write and anything I push into core, I'm thinking about, we could be dealing with this code in 20 years' time. Like, that's not insane to say.
No, not at all.
So yeah, I'm a real advocate for users and stuff like that. And one of the biggest, I'm trying to fill gaps in the REST API at the moment. So one of the things that were really bugging me were like menus weren't in core. So I added menus, but menus and menu items have different issues around security, because you never know when a menu's being used or if it's public or not. A post or a page, you can assume that it's public, whereas a menu item might be on a hidden page, might be drafted, it may be on a hidden page where it's like you've got an internal intranet that's got like redundancies, or like you have no idea what the menu items could say. So you've got to treat menu items as sensitive data, which is a bit annoying, because I would love to have made the data public and assumed it was public from the start. But unfortunately, the menu's endpoint, I had to put authentication on it. So you have to be logged in to be able to act. Like, these are the sort of problems that you have when you can't just assume that all data is public in WordPress, and these problems we're dealing with. The menus is one I'm really passionate about. Been working on the themes and plugins endpoints as well. So I love to get to the point where the REST API has full feature parity with the CMS. So the moment you can activate themes and you can install themes within the REST API. So like, you know, WordPress does a very poor job around like dependency management, but if you can use the REST API to say like, oh, we detect this plugin needs WooCommerce, click this button to install WooCommerce, and it makes a REST API call and it just goes away and does it. Like, there's so many UI experiences that we can do that would be amazing because you have the REST API for that. But yeah, like, to get REST APIs into core, you kind of have to use it through, you have to say, well, Gutenberg needs it. So then that's how we managed to get it in. And we managed to sneak it in via Gutenberg. But then I'm working on the same thing for themes, to be able to activate and update and install themes within the REST API. And at that point, we're somewhat feature parity with all the functionality in core. And I really hope somebody listening to this comes along and says, right, we're done with standard WordPress user interface. We're going to rewrite it all in React. We've got enough REST APIs that we can do everything. And we can, even if you just use it as like a remote control, so you could have a piece of software that sits there, you connect it to your various WordPress sites using, so WordPress has this idea of application passwords now. So that's some functionality we worked on in 5.6. Uh-huh. So you could register your remote client, and you could manage all your sites. You could get notifications. You could push things. Like, there's so many opportunities with REST API, and I'm excited to see what the community does with it. And I hope it's open source and that I can use it, and it's not behind some sort of paywall.
I was just going to say, I mean, that's exactly what I thought. It was like when you said, oh, we're almost at feature parity, I was like, great, now we can rewrite all the user interface.
All the user interface, yeah.
Like, it just, some of these pieces just need a little bit of love and attention, like, and updating.
And the last thing like that I would want to talk about is like the one of the last things that's not in the REST API are block data. So if people don't know, blocks are stored as this like blob of HTML comments, and it's a pain. Like, it's awful. Like, from a, if, visually it doesn't look great, and you can't, unless you instantiate a bunch of like Gutenberg libraries, you can't easily parse that into usable data. But there is some stuff in core already that allows you to turn those comments into a massive JSON object. So I've written a plugin that basically says, right, convert the block into a JSON object, render it out, and then make this data available as JSON. Once it's in JSON, then you have some amazing opportunities from a headless perspective, right?
So instead of
it being this massive HTML block that you then have to parse and muck around with every time you render the page, you could use this plugin to say, right, instead of rendering the content, I've now got an array of JSON objects where this is an image block, and I know the image source is this, and the alt is this, and da-da-da-da. Then I can take that and render that into whatever, you know, I'm assuming you'd want to write in React, but you could render it in whatever technology you want. Because you have the data in like a JSON format, the sky's the limit. You could use Python, you could use whatever technology you want and render it out wherever you want. And that's one massive opportunity that Gutenberg has given us, to give us structured data out of the content of the post. Before, it was just a HTML blob that you can do nothing with. Once everything's blocks and everything can be parsed down, you can then say, for this block, I can render using this JavaScript component, and this, and you can do, you know, if it doesn't do that, fall back to the HTML rendering. Like, there's so many options, and I just want to sing and shout about this plugin, and I'm sure it'll be in the show notes or whatever. But
for sure.
I did it for a client project, and to be fair, because I've been working on web stories and other things, I haven't really had time to work on it. But I do want to look back on it at some point, because again, with everything being blocks, this plugin becomes even more useful. So
yeah,
now that widgets are blocks, all your widgets have structured data. Also editing, you could get structured data out of your entire page layout. Like, there's so many amazing things that can come out of having structured data around basically every aspect. So not only the content, but even all the customizations like widgets and also editing can all be parsed JSON. Like, yeah.
Man, that's going to be, yeah.
Mega.
That's huge. Awesome. Because
it's a cool future. How does your plugin handle inner blocks? Because that's one of the things that I hear internally people talk about a lot. It's like, how does inner blocks work, right? Because that's like, when you write a block, I think there's an inner blocks component, and it's not like registered in the block.json file. So
what it does is there's a property of the JSON object called inner blocks, and that will be an array of nested blocks. But that can go
so deep,
all the levels down.
Okay.
So imagine you've got like a columns layout, right? So that's a column block, with the inner block of a column, and then within that you could have a paragraph, and then that you can have an image, and like
you can
get incredible levels of nested
rabbit hole.
I can't do much about that in my plugin, because that is just how it is. That's how the data is structured, but it can get pretty nuts after a while.
Yeah, and I think when we talked to Rob from Desertos last time, I think his team, they're using block data, but I think that they might have wrote their own parser in React, like using React HTML parser.
Yep.
But I think the solution that they came to like mitigate some of that problem was like they just disabled a bunch of like the layout blocks. So like you couldn't add columns, and that everything, you know, you could assume with some degree like how many levels this was going to go, because the biggest layout blocks weren't there.
The biggest problem is around, so most block attributes are stored in the HTML comment. So when you have a HTML comment, you can have like attributes, which is like a JSON object. Those are easy to parse, because I can just grab those out of the HTML comment.
Yeah.
But with blocks, you can also have attributes that are within HTML. So for the image block, the source is stored. You get that by parsing the HTML of the image tag and getting the source attribute. So in PHP, I've had to instantiate a library called pQuery, I think it's called.
What is it called?
pQuery.
pQuery, okay.
And it has to parse the HTML and say, find the image tag and then find me the source attribute for this. And that's incredibly resource intensive, because PHP is not really designed to parse HTML on the fly.
Right.
And one of the things that I need to do to improve the plugin, ideally, Gutenberg would not store its attributes in HTML, because that's a pretty nasty way of doing it. I understand why it was done, but from a data integrity standpoint, it's a bit weird for me. I don't understand why it was done that way. I'm sure there's a technical reason, and backwards compatibility, I'm sure, is probably the reason. But it makes it incredibly difficult to parse it in different languages, because unless it's stored as an attribute that's easy to get at, you have to do the HTML and stuff. My plans, if I get some time in February and when I'm at WordCamp Asia and when I'm on my flight and I've got nothing better to do, I probably won't watch the films. I'll probably hack on trying to add some caching and performance work on that.
Very cool. And the reason, like, I know that I just kind of wonder about the HTML comments thing and like why that choice is made. And somebody described that to me recently, was like, that was a backwards compatibility thing. Like, cause really? I look at the structured block data and I'm like, this kind of seems like the better way to store this. Like, this is a better representation than I think what the HTML is. And do you have any insight on that? And like why that decision was made?
As a maintainer of the Gutenberg project. Yeah. So the reason is so that you could upgrade to Gutenberg, edit your site, and then if you didn't like it, you could downgrade. So the downgrade process was not
painful.
My biggest issue is that makes sense when it comes to post content, right? If you install the classic editor and you want to downgrade, unfortunately, those HTML comments are now being used for everything. So full site editing is actually using two hidden post types called like WP layout and WP template and WP template part. And they also have that HTML comment system.
Oh.
And that's because of the technology that they've built. It makes sense to do that. But in an ideal world, we would have not created new custom post types. We would have created a new database table that stores a JSON blob and does this like properly and does it in a scalable way. It wasn't done that way. And I would have done it differently. I don't understand why they did it that way. It's backwards compatible and all this stuff, and it's easier to do. But at some point, I think there's going to be some enterprising person that goes out that will strip all that data out of the post table and create a new table that stores it in a different way that's more scalable. I mean, I think MySQL has this idea of like JSON fields, like a field that's designed to store JSON objects.
At least Postgres does. And that's queryable too. Like you can store JSON blobs and then say, I want, you know, look inside this and find me something with this, you know, and it's fast. It's very fast. So,
well, I mean, one of the biggest problems around having all the blocks be markup in the post content means that they're searchable. So go on any WordPress site now and search for the word paragraph. Every single post on your site will show up because the word paragraph appears in every single block. Because the block has the word is WP colon paragraph. And that text is in every bit of every WordPress site. So you could, you know, if you want to.
Now we're going to do it. After we get off the page, I'm going to mess around with it.
Yeah. Wow.
Go to a very large WordPress site and search for paragraph. You'll get 40,000 next pages because it'll be every single post on the site.
That's a lot.
That's nuts. So we got just a couple questions left. Johnny, you still got a couple minutes?
Yeah, go for it.
I know we're bumping. Okay, cool. So yeah, I definitely wanted to give you a chance. Like there was so much cool performance stuff that you all worked on. So definitely wanted to give you an opportunity to share that. Because I think like anything that just makes WordPress faster is awesome in my book.
Awesome. Yeah.
So November 2021, Google and Yoast, this idea of the performance project out there. As a performance expert, I was like, oh yeah, I'm well up for this. And got a team together, the company I was working for, to start contributing to Core. So Yoast and all the other companies have been working on these sort of really big bang things. So I think you've probably seen Google's working on converting all images to WebP. Unfortunately, Matt Mullenweg said no to that idea, and the Google team are currently in talks with them to try and push that initiative forward. I decided to go back to my list of like 60 issues that I found while I was working at Time. I just had this massive like grocery list of like bugs and issues that were bugging me, and I was like, oh, what do you want to work on? I'm like, all these things that I wrote 9 years ago, I just would love to like nerd out and fix all this stuff. And everyone's like, well, how'd you keep finding this stuff? It's like, yeah, I found it. Look how old the tickets are, man. Look. And managed to work through this backlog of changes. So a lot of it's like, just the biggest thing is about how data is loaded in WordPress. So if you don't load the data properly, it will do a single database query to get every single one. So I'll give you an example. Say you're on a page where every article is written by a different user. What WordPress would do is every time you loop through, it gets the author information, because obviously sometimes you render the little avatar and the name next to the article. But it would do a single database query to say, get me author one for the first post, and then author two, author three. So for every time you were rendering 10 posts, it was doing 10 database queries. Incredibly wasteful. We know at the start that what all these IDs are. So instead of doing it a single database query for each one, just do one database query to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, get all the users in one database query. And it's massively oversimplifying stuff, but that's so much of the work that I've been doing over the last year is just making sure that data is loaded properly in a way that makes sense. So preemptively loading post meta, loading terms where it makes sense, turning off terms where you don't, for post types that don't have terms or meta or any meta associated, like hidden post types, don't bother to do the database query for post meta and stuff like that. So I did, and no better example than this is like for the REST API. So we did tons of work around just running. So I use a tool called Query Monitor to analyze the number of queries that we run on the page. And a standard hit to the post endpoint was getting like 350 database queries.
Wow.
I was like, I ran the profile, and I was like, I'm sitting there going, whoa, that doesn't seem right. That seems absolutely nuts. And because it was just in tons of places. So it wasn't loading the authors properly. It often does a permission check to see if the parent post, if you have access to the parent post, wasn't loading the parents. Like there's so many obvious things. And all the changes in a lot of places were one or two lines of code changed. But I would just see these numbers sort of fall off a cliff. So once you load the data properly, you're seeing the data. So I think there's one REST API query that went down from 350 to 15 database queries.
Oh, wow.
And then when you're lowering that's nuts, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
That's a day when you step away from your keyboard and sort of go, right, I've earned my beer tonight. Like, it was awesome. So, similarly, the REST API has this idea of like links. So when you have a main object, you have like links in it. So so for a post, for example, it will link to like its comments, it will link to its revisions and its authors, like linked data,
terms
and all that sort of stuff. All that stuff's linked together. But you have this idea in the REST API being able to pass fields. So you can say, I just want the ID and I just want the post content. So you just get a smaller response. But it was still running all the database queries to get all this linked data. And that was incredibly wasteful. Like, because in some cases, there'd be like 5 or 6 different queries to get all that data for each post. So every time you get revisions, you have to do a single database query to get post. Just if you don't pass links in the fields, don't bother to run that. And again, we were seeing it go from 15 queries down to 2. And it was like, oh, cool. Like, awesome.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And considering Google is on record that they do index your REST APIs, because they're all public data, and Google will will parse your REST APIs, and they will parse your RSS feeds as well. Because Google, you're basically giving Google and your data in this very user-friendly version. Why wouldn't they parse it? Why wouldn't they take all that data? And if you consider that the REST APIs are getting hit by Google, they might be hit by users if you're using something like Infinite Scroll or you're using a headless site. Making those REST APIs as performant as possible, like, is really important.
It's important, man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that type of work, I feel like, that is super valuable, because like that, like you said, to go from 350 to 15, that's a huge improvement.
Two. Yeah.
But it's not like, I don't know. Like, I look at some of that work and I'm like, people don't think that's cool. Like, that's the sad thing. It's like performance nerds and like people like us were like, oh, wow, that's awesome. But it's not it's not splashy. It's not like, check out this new cool new feature. So I'm like super hyped that that stuff is getting worked on. So thank you to you and the team for spearheading that.
And just what I try and do with my Twitter account, I try and make these some of these numbers sexy, like trying like sharing graphs of like, look, the number was here and now it's down here. Like that's awesome. And people are like, well, why is that important? Because it's like, well, if you're getting 100,000 requests, 100,000 times 350 can take your database server down.
And having
worked for large big, some of these enterprise clients who managed to upset some people, people do try and DDoS your site. They will attack your site by just pummeling tons of traffic at you. And making those numbers smaller will massively mitigate those sort of problems. Instead of it being 100,000 requests, they might need to do 200,000 requests or a million requests. And then the hackers' resources end up being diminished because they don't have enough servers to do this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's when it becomes important. Like it's not a sexy number in itself, but what it means for you if it means that you can turn a database server off, you can lower your plan so you don't need to have to be on the enterprise plan for some hosting company like WP Engine. It's good.
I
was just going to say real quick, Jeff, this reminds me a lot of the issues we solve internally when people like Johnny, lowering that, banging your WordPress server so you don't DDoS it. That happens in Headless with Next.js when you're like prefetching and getting this, getting the static paths, remember? And you're taking, because you're asking WordPress for all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's important that we optimize these things that are unsexy, because at the end of the day, these unsexy things, these are the things that most people, when they have like a business critical site, are having issues with, but it's just not on the front end. It's not on the, so anyway.
It's not a feature.
No.
I think people assume that the REST API is a backend feature that it's just for Gutenberg and it's never going to be hit publicly. But with the surgence of headless stuff, that is not true. Tons of traffic are hitting these pages. And we shouldn't need to use CDNs and stuff to protect against it. It should just scale out of the box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd really love to see this is probably impossible, but I feel like what would make this sexy to people is if you were like, all right, what did that? So on one site, one API call, like we made, I don't know, 200, we removed 260 database queries. If you were to extrapolate that out in terms of resource usage or electricity across every WordPress site, it's probably you saved enough electricity in one day to like power Croatia or something.
Carbon
like
footprint
that.
Lower.
Like, I really feel like there's that N is large enough that even these small tweaks in the aggregate, that just made humanity better. Like, I don't know.
One of the things I worked on in core was lazy loading images. So, it's the idea of you can add this little attribute to an image and say, don't download this image until it's in viewport or is about to be scrolled down. That is incredibly powerful when you think about it. So I traveled around South America and saw some real poverty when I was there. Yeah. And sometimes I was in places where I had 2G connection. Yep. And I was trying to load the BBC News homepage, and that's a well-optimized page, to be fair. They got some very good engineers there, but the images weren't downloading and I couldn't see the page, and it was chewing through my data. I couldn't access it. With lazy loading images, it means that the page can render and when it can kick in and when you can get it. And that makes the web a much more accessible place, because not everyone has these crazy 5G connections and a half gig connection like I've got here. Like we are about democratizing publishing, and I do fundamentally believe in that. And how people get out of poverty and how they can make their lives better in these incredibly poor parts of the world is information. Mm-hmm. Imagine they're loading a web page about how to get clean water or healthcare or something like. Yeah, that information could be life-saving in those developing countries. So, we're incredibly privileged in the world that we live in, that I just have fast internet literally everywhere I go. I can walk down my local high street and there's 10 coffee shops with insane internet, but that is not the majority of the world.
Yeah. Nope. I mean,
that's a good idea. Democratizing publishing. Yeah. So we've got two more questions left, and these are somewhat fun questions. I like to ask this to all of our guests. So if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about WordPress core that would make it easier to create headless sites, what would it be? And I feel like you've actually suggested five things already.
Yeah. I feel like you did already.
One thing I'm keen to work on is to make the REST API more performant. So I'm gonna try and build a caching plugin that's cleverer, that will cache all those requests and then do caching validation around that. So I'm putting my money where I'm not gonna wave a magic wand. I'm gonna write the code.
Oh, there you go.
Money where my mouth is.
You don't need magic.
No, I'm a core committer, so I get the opportunity. Like, a lot of the things that I would have said that I would have waved the magic wand, I have had a chance to fix stuff. So I'm putting my money in my mouth is I'm going to put myself in public to say this. I'm going to try and write a plugin that will cache a lot of those like post and term endpoints and then do some clever caching validation.
Oh, that would be super cool. Super cool.
Because, that would be super cool for the REST API. Yeah.
The other one would be the thing I mentioned before around having block data, structured block data in the REST API. Instead of that to not be a plugin, I love that to just be in core.
Yeah, I think that would be really cool. And I think too, like I know Jason Ball has written a number of kind of like treaties on, you know, like decoupled stuff in the block editor. And I guess really like the other sticking point is like that it doesn't validate block data either. Like if I were to try to post block data, right, that's got to run through the front end JavaScript Gutenberg thing.
Yeah, it's not very decoupled, is it? You really do still have to, even if you're, it implies you're in this JavaScript world and you can install these packages. You can do it, but if you're pushing from a Python application or, you know, Ruby or something else that doesn't know anything about the block editor, you can't do that at the moment. Just assuming that your client is JavaScript, especially as how fast web technology moves, I think that's unwise. And in the future, when JavaScript's not the cool new hotness in 5 years' time, where will we be?
WebAssembly.
Everybody's the cool new hotness will be. Yeah, hopefully I'll be retired by then. But do we have time? Do we have one question left, Jeff? The last one that I always
just answer. your fun question.
Okay, Johnny, last question of the podcast, and we appreciate you. But I got to tell you, I'm super grateful for you being on here because this was a whole educational piece for me. I learned a lot about WordPress core and blocks and the database actually for WordPress and optimization of REST, because I didn't realize, like, Jason Ball has the smart cache plugin right now for WP GraphQL that gets your data, gets it fast and gets it accurate, so that you're not banging your WordPress server. To do that on the REST end, stoked for that. That is super sick. But when you're not doing code and not messing with WordPress, Johnny, like for fun, what do you do to decompress, man?
I love to travel. I've been to 50 countries at this point. I plan to go to another 8 this year. I just love traveling. I've been around a lot of the US and Canada as well. So not countries, but I've been to like probably 15 states or something like that. And I love photography as well. So I think it goes along with travel as well. So like taking photos of the stuff that I've seen. But as a Brit, I'm so lucky. Like I can go to a European country on a weekend and it costs me like $100 to get a flight. Like it's so cheap. It's 2 hours on a plane. Like it's nothing. I can go to another country. It's absolutely amazing. But travel. I think it's never not enriched me every time I go. Like just realizing that like the world, your way of living is one way of living and another way of living. Particularly traveling around South America. I mentioned it very briefly a minute ago, but like seeing poverty and seeing that was incredibly eye-opening and made me so passionate about making the web performant, because I could see, oh, it saves 1 millisecond time off my load time here in my fast connection. That could be the difference between it loading or not loading in a country where, where you're on a 2G connection. So it just, incredibly enriching to travel.
15 years ago, I did a mission trip with my mom this kind of goes on to your point about like just eye-opening places in poverty, that there was like no internet. Oh, we went to Calcutta, India, which was, I mean, this number one, the infrastructure in these poor places in India is terrible. But yeah, it just opens your eyes. We're like, man, I come from the three of us here come from a great, we have privilege and that's okay, because we have these tools and these computers at our hand to, like Johnny said, make the world a better place by giving more information out through the web and everything like that. So that's awesome to hear, man. And I will tell you this, if you ever, I don't know when you're coming back to the States, Johnny, but
let us know.
You're super cool. If you're ever in Austin, Texas, man, that's where I live. Come look me up. I'll, you know, maybe grab a pint.
We'll get a WordPress meetup, pop-up WordPress meetup.
Definitely.
WP Engine's headquarters is here too, and I can show you the office and stuff like that. So
I love that. Yeah, it'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Johnny, so much for your time. This has been, like Fran said, I think super educational for all of us, definitely for our listeners.
Thanks for listening to me, and I get to nerd out about WordPress, which is my favorite topic to nerd out about.
I can just waffle
for hours about this stuff, and if you ever want me to have me back on again, I'd be more than
I feel like we should on.
Sure,
just because there's more stuff
we could have done a whole hour on just Ludicrous DB or just the REST API, so definitely we will hit you up and have you back on again. And if, like I said, we'll definitely share some links to your projects, your sites and plugins and stuff in the show notes, so we can get you a little bit of publicity there. But again, thank you so much for being gracious with your time, and thank you for your work on the REST API. Like I said, I mean, that probably saved enough electricity to power Croatia for a day. So like, that's really cool work and impactful.
All right, y'all.
All right. Yep.
Cheers.
Rock on. Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Headless WP podcast. If you liked today's episode, go ahead and give us a share or a like on whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to keep in touch with the WP Engine Developer Relations team on Twitter, Discord, or through our website. Thanks for listening.